Hello and welcome to the fifth episode of Club Soderberg, the podcast that takes a temporarily pedantic approach to deconstructing the film oeuvre of one Steven Soderbergh. My name is Jessie Scott and I'm your host for today. I'm joined as usual by Carla Donnelly.
Hi.
Maggie Scott.
Hello.
And I'm very excited to announce that we are also joined today by a special guest host, Lee Zachariah. Lee is a fellow film buff, soda nerd, film critic, pop culture vulture, and diehard fan of Erin Brockovich, so we're very excited to have him on board to share his thoughts today. Lee, perhaps you'd like to say a few words.
Oh, perhaps I would, but perhaps I wouldn't. No, thank you for having me. First time, long time, big fan of the show. Honoured to be your first guest.
Yada, yada.
No, it's a real pleasure. I've been a massive Soderbergh fan for many years, and I'm always delighted to talk about him whenever given the opportunity.
Excellent.
Or sometimes when I'm not given the opportunity, I just take the opportunity. Like how you guys tried locking the door, but I found an open window.
Yeah.
So thanks for having me.
Great. So today we reach the moment where Soderbergh's career as a Hollywood director is truly minted. Both today's films, Erin Brockovich and Traffic, were released in the year 2000, and both were nominated for Academy Awards in the same year. Julia Roberts got the gong for Best Actress in the former, and Soderbergh for Best Director in the latter. A pretty remarkable feat, considering one film was about a poor, uneducated single mother taking on big energy, and the other a non-linear ensemble piece shot in Dogma style by Soderbergh himself about the logistics of drug trafficking. As has become his custom in this era, Soderbergh is mainly balancing mainstream big-budget production process against his instincts to deconstruct genre, to mess with form, and to really get his hands on in the making of his own films. Erin Brockovich is a deceptively straight-ahead David versus Goliath narrative, done in a relatively conservative style that has an incredibly subversive core. Traffic, on the other hand, is an almost bizarrely experimental film considering the level of budget and star power it was wielding. I'm going to hand over to Maggie now to introduce Erin Brockovich, and I'm particularly looking forward to this discussion today.
What makes you think you can just walk in there and find what we need?
They're called boobs, Ed.
Okay, so the first of our issue-based films today is Erin Brockovich. Julia Roberts plays Erin, a spunky single mom with three kids and a whole lot of smarts, as well as a big love of that Julia Roberts hair, push-up bras and kitten heels. In the course of looking for a job to support her family, she comes in contact with Ed Masri, a lawyer played by Albert Finney. In her desperation, she bullies and guilts him into giving her a job at his firm. We see her lugging her kids in and out of shitty childcare situations with neighbours and acquaintances and getting crap from co-workers who assume she's nothing but a bimbo. But she works hard and has an eagle eye and spots some anomalies in a case that she's filing. When she follows them up, she discovers that a major utility company has contaminated the water wells of the small Californian town of Hinckley and that the residents suffer a range of illnesses that are supposedly the result of this contamination. Ed and Erin decide to sue, and with obstacles in both the case and Erin's personal life along the way, they are ultimately successful with the largest settlement for a direct action lawsuit in American history at $333 million. So this is a biopic slash drama, and it's definitely Oscar bait and a vehicle for Julia Roberts to show her acting chops. The budget was $52 million US, with $20 million to Julia, which is the highest fee yet to be paid to an actress at that time, and she had final say in the director, and I dare say that she went with Soderbergh because he was known for his actor whispering. What I loved most about this film, besides Soderbergh's remarkable ability to make document shots look really artistic, were the feminist moments that seemed well ahead of their time for this mainstream film. Mm. So for me, like, I loved moments when Erin is unapologetic about her need to work for her own sanity and intellectual stimulation. She feels bad for her kids and their childcare situation, but asserts that they will understand when they are older. My favourite scene, I think, is when she tells her boyfriend, played by Aaron Eckhart, that she's not going to quit her job, and he's, you know, begging with her because he loves her and wants to have a relationship, and she's just like, you know, if you understood, you'd stay. And that's just completely, you know, she's not even going to sway on that matter. And that's, you know, quite remarkable for its time, I thought. She tells Ed Masry, the lawyer, where to go when he asks her to dress more appropriately, and she doesn't need her co-worker's approval. And another thing is all the plaintiffs that we see that she talks to are women, and some of her most angelic moments are for them, and that's who she's sacrificing everything for. I really enjoyed the film, but I cringed a lot at the really obvious kind of Oscar baity scenes. You know, but having said that, there's a really interesting tension between that star vehicle element of the movie, the fact that it's all about Julia, it's made for her, but at the same time, it's got serious issues in it. And I think that when I did a bit of Googling, I noticed that it's very much in the top five of all environmental films. I think that the film actually had a big...
Would that be hard, though?
It's interesting that a sort of Hollywood, you know, Oscar baity type film is also considered. Mm. Like, it did a lot.
A serious
case. Like it,
environmental...
Yeah, yeah, it raised the publicity of the case. It had real influence on policy decisions, and, you know, legal kind of, you know, practice, all that sort of stuff. And I noticed that it was also on those top five lists with Chinatown, the movie Chinatown, and which is also about water wars in California, and the little people struggle against authority and power. They're very different movies. But there's some strong parallels between the character of Erin Brockovich and Jake Giddies, who's played by Jack Nicholson in Chinatown. So I'm going to throw this one to Lee and see if you think that there's some parallels between Erin and Jake.
Yeah, I had never made that connection before. Of course, Jack Nicholson does that, have that famous line, "They're called boobs, Ed." But, aside from that, I never actually connected that, because even though, of course, that's what Chinatown is about, it seems like sort of an excuse to talk about deeper themes, whereas Erin Brockovich puts it a lot more front and centre. Like, the drama is rooted in the environmental catastrophe and what big business does to small people when it can get away with it. I do like that comparison, though. I'm going to have to give Chinatown another spin soon. And
I watched it, and I should have. Yeah, I was just thinking that, you know, they're very different films. One has a very dark, messed up ending. One's very happy ending. But I was thinking it's interesting, Erin, you know, investigating water, it's sort of like she's investigate like a private eye in some ways, like Jake Giddies, but she has many of similar traits. Like, she's kind of not that likable, you know. She blows up at people like Jake does. She's not violent, but she kind of, you know, she yells and screams and you know. And I think, you know, I wonder if Soderbergh saw the parallels between, you know, because he did this in Out of Sight as well, like where J-Lo is the, you know, is the one that's chasing the sort of, you know, the hot guy in that, like, you know, he likes to turn the table. So I just, you know, found that an interesting...
That is a really interesting thing. I think that, like what Lee said, that in Chinatown it is sort of just a backdrop to this, you know, noir kind of genre story. But I think that's interesting in itself, in that could be a backdrop. Like, that is... I think that it shows a shift. With Erin Brockovich, I think the shift is that actually people are not just accepting this type of treatment anymore. Like, I think that's what's really powerful and interesting about the film, apart from its feminist kind of aspects, is that, you know, it was one of the first films to kind of show the people fighting back against that successfully.
Then in real life that did kind of play out as well, because you know, had a huge, you know, and I think I mean probably it was part of a movement to, you know, people understanding what, you know, how big corporations.
Yeah, well, class action lawsuits as well.
Like, yeah, the Chinatown's quite nihilistic. Like, the ending is quite, you know, it's just sort of like...
There's no point struggling.
There's no point struggling, yeah.
You're going to win.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't seen Chinatown, so I can't contribute. But I want to ask you why this is one of your favourite films, Lee.
I have been asking myself that for a long time because it's not considered... I think amongst cinephiles, it's not really considered top-tier Soderbergh the way something like Traffic is. But for me, it's I've never quite understood the dismissal of it as a TV movie. I think that purely comes from the fact that it's a woman in the lead and it's a social issues movie, and that's about it. If it was... you know, George Clooney playing I don't know, someone called Michael Clayton, it would be, oh yeah, Oscar. No one would ever consider that a TV movie. But I think it's a very welcoming story, and it's told in a very welcoming way where you're drawn into, it is quite uplifting, and there are lots of punch-the-air moments. You know, most characters get their own little moment. I mean... Ed Masri's $28 billion. I didn't know it was that much. Yeah. Wow! Like, one of the best lines of the film. And you know, there are at least three or four points in the film where you're just, you know, you're punching the air. But you know, Soderbergh has this indie lens that I find so much more appealing than glossy cinematography designed to draw you in. You're not looking at a painting. You feel like you're there, and it's this. He gives you these really warm colours. Mm. Every place, even the ugliest desert where there's some... She's investigating some sort of, you know...
Dead frog
in water. The temperature is really nice, and you're like, I could hang out there, I think. That looks kind of pleasant.
Might buy a house there.
Yeah. But the Thomas Newman's... Thomas Newman is a composer I'm obsessed with, and this is the first time Soderbergh's worked with him. And he's got this idiosyncratic score that is so addictive and so counter to what we're seeing on screen, but sort of works with it. It's kind of like Erin a bit in that she's very appealing, but she's also rubbing you up the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
So it matches her really well. I did want to throw something back to you guys, because after I've seen it so many times and rewatching it again, there was something that occurred to me that I'd never thought of before. And that is that for a film so much of the film is based on the fact that she dresses the way she does and women disparage her and men leer at her and she's got to fight against all the sexism because that's what she wants to look like. However, most of the negativity, in fact, I'd say nearly all the negativity, comes from the women in the film.
Mm.
And it's almost a... And I'm not saying none of this happened in real life. I'm not going to comment on how true it is because, you know, the real Erin Brockovich said, yeah, it's about 98-99% true. But watching it, it occurred to me that there is an appeal in the suggestion that deep down everyone is good. I find, as a male, it appealing that the biker next door making all the noise turns out to be great with kids. That the creepy guy staring at you in the bar actually just wants to talk about his cousin and give you some documents. Like, I actually struggle to think of a man in this. You know, Ed Masri is like charmingly chaste and sort of, you know, only vaguely aware that Erin is an attractive woman in low-cut tops.
Mm.
And there is... I can't think of a man who is outright... misogynistic towards her in the entirety of this film, and I'm not, you know, it hasn't lowered the opinion of the film because I still really love it. I still find it very very appealing film to watch. But I was wondering what you guys thought of that.
I totally noticed that.
Yeah.
Straight up. I mean, I think that this film definitely has some amazing feminist moments, but the things that made me feel a bit ill were exactly what you're talking about. So the kind of implication that, you know, the other women in the office were cutting her out because of the way she dressed. And then she makes some really nasty comment to one of them about, it calls her...
some horrible comment.
Krispy Kreme. Fat-shames her colleague. And I thought that stuff was not true to my experience of women in the workplace, certainly. But I don't know, maybe it was for her... for Erin, maybe that comes from real life. But yeah, I definitely noticed it, and I thought that it made me feel a bit weird.
But then there's also like the women that she's fighting the case for. You know, there's lots of scenes of her like just staring down, be typically like an angel. You know, like
this they're all mothers though. So yeah. It's all the working women who are the kind of who are portrayed as, you know, antagonists to her. So the lawyer woman as well. Yeah, you know, she's really mean to her, like for like no apparent reason.
That's a really kind of.
Yeah, but I think like the whole basis of, and I find it interesting, I didn't know that this wasn't a Soderbergh-driven project. He was selected for the project. But I think all of this really, I've sort of psychologically unpacked it to understand that, you know, it's really played straight. Like he's just really told the story like the beat of a drum. Like it just rolls out like a scroll, you know, like there's very little affectation or judgment or anything like that. Because I think in his inner world of development, like, so he's probably my age by the time he makes his film, maybe a little bit older, maybe he's about 40. He spent most of his career decompressing or unpacking men, how he sees himself, how he sees his behavior, how he sees his relationship with his father or fathers and sons, you know, what a beautiful man is able to get away with. And I really feel like this film is like the mirror inverse of The Underneath. Like, I feel like The Underneath is, like, what a beautiful man can get away with because, you know, all men have sickness in their heart. And
it's true.
But then also, like, well, what happens to a beautiful woman? And I think that's really, like, the core of the message of this movie. Like, and what he is obsessed with the actors that he chooses, it's, like, beauty privilege and people being not given the kinds of opportunities that they may be really good at because of how they look or how they appear or how they conduct themselves in the world. So I feel like this storyline is like a home run for him and what he's obsessed with, and that's the reason why he can portray it in such a plain, cinematic, just tell the story kind of way. But I really do believe that if you're that intelligent, and she's obviously extraordinarily intelligent as a woman, well, as a person, but you're also a beauty queen who's got two deadbeat ex-husbands. That's where the misogyny comes in, by the way. She's experienced all the misogyny before the movie begins. Mm. You've got two deadbeat ex-husbands. You've got three kids. You're white trash. And the only thing that you've really had to capitalize on your whole life is your image. Mm. There's a little bit of, like, feminist, what's called lateral violence, which is patriarchal lateral violence, which is in order for me to succeed in competition to you, I have to tear you down because only one of us will be able to succeed, not two. So I think that really is the, like, even though the people win in the end and la la la, to me the core of the story is about people not being taken seriously because of how they appear, and appearances are deceptive, and
I think that's true, and I think that he was very concerned with kind of, from what I've read anyway, with kind of staying true to who she is and representing that she wasn't a perfect mother, that she's quite abrasive, that she's kind of... I mean, I thought Julia Roberts was... It's quite a remarkable performance. Like, she's so angry. She's so angry in this film. Like, the character is so pissed off at the world and where she's ended up and why people won't take her seriously. And that's so powerful. But it's also really confronting. Like, and
haven't we all felt that though?
Of course,
women?
Yeah.
Particularly as women, like, to just be constantly derided, you know, in many different aspects of your life and in many different ways. Like, I've felt like her for the past 5 years of my life. Like, when you have that light bulb moment of like, oh, I didn't get that because I'm a woman, or I didn't get that because I feel like this, I look like this, or, you know, I behave like this. But I got all of this, three kids, two ex-husbands, you know, because of, you know, so, yeah. So how does that square, Lee?
I'm not going to disagree with that.
I reckon that as well, maybe he didn't, Soderbergh or the scriptwriter chose not to have those moments of misogyny that you're talking about because from men, because her life already looks pretty shit. Like, I think her carting around her kids to really awful childcare situations is pretty depressing.
Mm.
Like, that's, you know, that's the result of, the, like you say, the misogyny that she's already experienced, or the, you know,
Yeah, and the fact that she can't get a job as a single mother.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that she doesn't have access to education, or she hasn't had access to education. And that a doctor
with a Jaguar knocking into her is still going to get away with,
exactly, you know,
breaking her neck. Then,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How many ex-husbands do you have? That line from that lawyer.
Yeah.
It gets is designed to get you mad right off the bat and works because it's like, yeah, she was still in the right, like,
yeah,
when the guy smashed into her. Like, I guess there is that implication that she's experienced all the misogyny has already happened up until that point. So it's like, yeah, at least two guys have left her with all these kids and the judicial system is working against her. And we've kind of, maybe that's the bedrock of the whole thing. And now now this is how we come out of that. It's a redemption story.
Not so much redemption, but taking the power back, because, like, also if you think about it, all the people that have power over her in her life are men.
Mm.
All of them, including the boyfriend that she very hesitantly, you know, brings into her life. And I didn't see your explanation of what she said about her job being the same as you, Maggie. Like, I saw her just being, like, quite shitty to him and just being like, well, you need to pay for the sins of the other men that have come before you. And so if you don't understand that and you can't stay around, basically, like, I had to chuck you under the bus to understand that, you know.
See, I saw it differently again.
Ah!
I did, because I think we were all quite affected by that moment.
Yeah.
But I think that when I watched it, I felt, I was like, part of me was like, right on, sister. And part of me was like, that's so fucking tragic, because what that moment says is that women have had to play handmaiden to men for thousands of years, have had to support them to achieve the things they want to achieve. And now that we have equality, men are not actually willing to do the same thing for us. Like, that's what's really sad about it, is that she's sort of drawing a line. She's saying, no, this is my life. This is what I'm committed to. You can either help me or
But get I don't out. Think I don't think it was a lack of support in that room. I think he was saying, like, I'm lonely. You're never at home.
I know, but our relationship is suffering. How many women were lonely, you know?
Totally. For
their men going off to work, you know, like, and having great intellectual and, sure, you know, so I think
but how many of them were also miserable, taking Valium, sleeping with the postman?
Absolutely. But I'm just saying, for me, it was like this sad moment.
No,
like,
we can't
expect men to do that, because we didn't enjoy it either.
It's interesting the way they layer that in. It's like, it's almost like they have a massive contract negotiation at the beginning where he's like, let's get together, and she's like, okay, here's the deal. I've got these three kids. You need to be here. I can't have you running off. I've got this job. And he's like, that's fine. And, like, they've both figured it out and they're both on board, except her job turns into this thing she couldn't have expected.
Yeah.
And he's like, all I need is this, like, a bit more attention from you. And he's hearing the other motorbikes go past on the road, and you can see
that was so
his
cheesy.
Dream. I love it.
Do you know what the cheesiest
Daddy.
Moment was? The cheesiest moment was when she took him once they won the case, and she took him
to that person.
And he's like, she's like, I want you to see this. And he's just like, I can't really see me right now.
Aaron Eckhart.
She's eating grit.
Aaron Eckhart. So good. I love Aaron Eckhart.
Oh, my God. That can we talk about how bad that wig was? There's only, like, two really bad things in this movie. His wig and, like, her hoochie clothes were so new. Like,
yes, they were.
So pressed.
They were too new, weren't they?
Yeah,
I actually have a note here that I found her wardrobe really unconvincing, and I couldn't quite put my finger on why.
Yeah.
It's because it was all too...
Yeah, just, like, straight off the rack.
Yeah. She's not...
So to
she's
speak.
Not a,
yeah. Boom.
I say.
I had another obscure film reference that... Probably none of you have seen this film. Maybe, I don't know. Has anyone seen Wanda by Barbara Loden?
No.
So Barbara Loden was married to Elia Kazan. She was an actress much younger than him. And she made one film. She worked as an actress, and she was kind of Elia Kazan's muse. And she made one film before she died called Wanda. And it was... So it's in the 70s, so it's sort of 20 years before this movie. But it's a very similar kind of character.
Mm.
So she's got two kids with a husband, and she abandons them. She's very unhappy and she just leaves. And then you just see her kind of, it's like this crazy road movie where she just kind of is wandering in the world, like, with no place to go. And she just sort of ends up with a sequence of horrible men. And it is absolutely devastating. She's really low, like, low socioeconomic kind of white trash, uneducated, and it's really devastating, because, like, the whole message of that movie is, like, you know, sure, the feminist movement happened, but who did it leave behind, you know, in terms of it not treating all women equally? So if you didn't have an education, if you didn't come from a middle-class background, there still really was no place in the world for a single woman without a man to kind of...
supplement the income.
To shepherd her, because there was no place for single women. Like, the world didn't know what to do with them. So I found this film a really interesting kind of bookend, almost, that, like... you know, this character does find a way to kind of have a place in the world and get respect and all those things for her sort of id and herself to kind of be expressed or whatever.
Yeah, but I think there's a danger in that as well. Like, as much as I think that this is totally an uplifting film and it's amazing and it, you know, kind of feeds into the whole American dream, quote unquote, I think it's kind of propaganda-ish in a way. Like, to just completely go back to the Aaron Eckhart moment as well, when you were talking about that, Lee, it just made me realize, like, no, it is that perfect feminist moment of like, yeah, babe, sure, you can go work, I'll mind the kids, and then it's like, yeah, but not like that. Right, that's what ends up eventually happening. Like, yeah, I'm a feminist, sure, go and do whatever you want. Oh no, but it actually affects me. No, I don't agree with that. So I do feel like it's a propaganda machine in a way. But at the same time, I think as watching Soderbergh as a man develop, like get to his 40s, I think it's a really sweet moment. And you see, to me, as we're looking down the barrel of the next decade, his treatment of, first of all, it's his first film that stars a woman. That's pretty full on in like a 13-year career. But also that he seems to kind of leave like the bad man, bad daddy man soul searching behind at this point and just sort of moves forward into a new decade of really exploring interesting characters with women. And
well, he actually says that all of his films to this point were sort of a little bit autobiographical or about his cohort of colleagues and friends, and this definitely marks a shift where he's like, I wanted to step out of myself and make movies about other people. And I think, yeah, definitely that comes through, that like it's sort of, he said it was great for his imagination to sort of start to see outside his own.
Interesting, though, that you're having that shift, but he also is the first film that's very linear. So all the men's stories that he's been telling are kind of fragmented, you know, non-linear storylines, and then this one's like he describes it as aggressively linear. But you know, like we were talking about before, we listened to the deleted scenes commentary on the Aaron Brockovich video, and a lot of work goes into making an aggressively linear story, like a good one. You need to edit the crap out of it and to really focus on what the story is, and
It's amazing how much they shot for this film that never made it. Whole subplots and storylines
and that it's 2 hours long, and I just found it gripping. I just want to talk about, like, I actually, not only did I find this film entertaining, and you've said to me, Lee, that you know you think this film is perfect, and I would actually agree. Like, there is just nothing out of place in this. It just rolls out at this beautiful pace. It's just gripping. It's like thrilling in these moments. It gives you these like little peps of, you know, endorphins at like specific points. And you're like, ah, you know, it's almost like a Punch and Judy kind of thing. Like, you're like, boo, yay, you know. And then at the end, you're like, yeah. Just masterful.
Yeah.
How do people feel about Julia in this film? I'm just curious, because that was always my bugbear with this film when I was younger. Like, when it first came out, I always felt like she was too much a Hollywood star, like that she, you know, we so associate her with her kind of rom-com movies. I love her, don't get me wrong. But I always felt like she was too much a star to carry this character, and that reflecting upon it now, I thought if it was cast now, I can see someone like a Jennifer Lawrence in this film as having a little bit more believable life texture or something. However, I think it was an amazing performance. So I don't know, did you have any feelings about that?
I've always loved her in this role. I've always thought, yeah, Julia Roberts was quite underrated, and I think she's perfect in this role. And again, something has kind of always rubbed me up the wrong way about her performance, as much as I loved it. And I think what it is that the movie star part of her shines through a little bit. And even though she's nailing this character and she's believable in every scene, there are hints where you can almost see her going, this is my moment of charm. This is where I'm going to smile and to myself, like, oh, well, he understands now. My son's getting the eggs. And, you know, and there are just a few too many moments of that feel like they're in a movie rather than in real life. And yeah, it's just interesting to see that sort of movie star instinct break through, you know, just these little cracks here and there.
She isn't quite natural with those children, though. You have seen some actresses where they're like, you just know, they just hold them. They just sort of punt them to somebody off screen as soon as it's like the clapboard goes down.
Yeah.
That is true. She's like letting the baby teeth on her finger. She's ad-libbing when the baby starts ad-libbing and she's going along with it. I love that movie.
I never saw it because of her. So this is the first time I ever saw this movie. It's not that I don't like her. It's just I have a perception that I don't like the films that she's in.
Right.
So
have you seen My Best Friend's Wedding?
No.
Greatest rom-com of all time.
Okay. All right.
She's great. She's great. Yeah.
I can't believe you brought my daughter to this place.
Whoa. Why don't you just back the fuck up, man? To this place? What is that shit? Okay, right now, all over this great nation of ours, 100,000 white people from the suburbs are cruising around downtown, asking every black person they see, you got any drugs? You know where I can score some drugs? Think about the effect that has on the psyche of a black person, on their possibilities. I guarantee you, you bring 100,000 black people into your neighborhood, into fucking Indian Hill, and they're asking every white person they see, you got any drugs? You know where I can score some drugs? Within a day, everyone would be selling. Your friends, their kids. Here's why. It's an unbeatable market force, man. It's a 300% markup value. You can go out on the street and make $500 in 2 hours, come back and do whatever you want to do with the rest of your day. And I'm sorry, you're telling me that you're telling me that white people will still be going to law school?
Okay, so hot on the heels of Erin Brockovich comes an equally crowd-pleasing but quite different film, Traffic. Adapted from a 1989 British miniseries of the same name, it's a sprawling, non-linear, documentary-style examination of the drug trade. It follows a number of crisscrossing storylines, including one about the national drug czar, played by Michael Douglas, and his heroin-addicted daughter, two entrepreneurial small-time cops in Mexico who are getting paid off by the military, the local drug cartel, and the American DEA, an American trophy wife, played by Catherine Zeta-Jones, whose husband has been living a double life as a major drug importer, and a number of others. It's also shot in a highly experimental manner, which we can talk about in more detail in the discussion, and has Carla Donnelly Kryptonite, another Cliff Martinez soundtrack, as well as being shot handheld.
And 2.5 hours
and
long.
And 2.5 hours long. Traffic was hugely critically acclaimed and very successful at the box office and seemed to capture a really important moment in time as Americans were becoming more aware of the burgeoning crisis playing out across the US-Mexico border. Which seems kind of weird to me now that it was so successful, as even though it has plenty of emotional hooks, it's much more focused on balancing the various logistical plot strands it's trying to unravel to get a picture of the whole issue, and it doesn't offer any pat solutions. I found it fascinating to rewatch this film, which I found really confusing the first time round, in the post-The Wire, post-Breaking Bad era. I'm wondering if or how much you guys think that, in fact, Traffic lay the groundwork for those canonical texts of drug trafficking, enabling us to understand both the complex subject matter and the non-linear way it's explained, or am I drawing too long a bow?
No, I instantly thought of The Wire, which I also found extremely boring and really long. Yeah, but before I, like, you know, started launching out with a bummer... Someone else talk about this film. What about The Wire or Breaking Bad?
Yeah, I can definitely see this film as the progenitor for those films. I'd never thought of that before, but it makes total sense. It was, I think this film predated both of those. Something just blew away. this film hit. I think we got Erin Brockovich and Traffic at roughly the same time in Australia. It's like they hold off all the Oscar. Films until it's Oscar time so they could promote, and so we got those at the same time, and also my friend ordered The Limey, which hadn't been released here, ordered in from overseas, so I got this 1-2-3 hit of Soderbergh all at once, and just that was the moment that I completely fell in love. And Traffic is not a film, not a style of film I thought I liked. You know, I like, you know, growing up on Hollywood musicals and Marx Brothers films, did not think Traffic would appeal to me. as much as it did, but there is something in the way he did it. And I think that's part of why it was so successful, is he brought a style to a relatively unappealing subject matter that draws you in. He quite deliberately cast movie stars. It's the Ocean's 11 rule, where he's like, this film needs movie stars all the more, so people will come see it, like Haywire. He shoots it in this... I mean, I've really devoted most of the last 15 years to figuring out why I love Soderbergh so much. And I've been inching towards it and certainly preparing for this show. I think I realized what it is about the style, particularly with Traffic, is that it feels so improvised. He only ever gives us the bare essentials. He's got these guerrilla sensibilities, you know, talking about using natural light, that early courtroom scene, you know, massive courtroom, Michael Douglas presiding, talking to the lawyers, and it's all natural light.
Yeah.
And he tints it all blue, and we find it visually arresting because it's such a primary color. And I think that authenticity comes from the shooting is as real and laid back, but there are jump cuts in even the most standard dialogue scenes. There are jump cuts, and it gives that feeling that even though they're unnatural, it makes us feel like he's been handed all this documentary footage.
Yeah.
And he's just had to cut it together into a film. And it's almost like a fly on the wall thing, and he's working with what he's given. All these solutions are in the editing room. The track is mono. It's a mono audio track.
Really?
Yeah, and that's a sort of technical detail I don't think most people think about. I certainly didn't until I heard him say it. And I realized, of course, you know, in the real world, we don't have omnidirectional mics and stereo and 5.1. It's just one mic stuck at whatever you're shooting at, pointed at that. And so subconsciously, that will make us feel like what we're watching is real. And I think that's the key to...
Detail.
Yeah. He really, really uses these technical tricks to make us feel like it's all real, what we're watching is real. I've gone off on a massive tangent, barely talked about the plot.
No, I think that's really interesting because I think most of the things I find really interesting about this film are technical details, like the kind of weird processes that he went through in exposing the film.
Yeah.
Like, he shot it himself and he shot most of it overexposed, and then he went through this weird flashing process, which is like to expose the film a little bit before shooting so that the darks could come in with more detail, so then you could have these really contrasty images with, you know, a good tonal range. Like, all this, like, obsessive kind of, like, weird nerdery that he kind of gets into. Like, I found that stuff fascinating. And, yeah, he also talks about how he just wanted it to feel like it was moving constantly, like it was being constantly propelled forward. And even though it is 2.5 hours long, I didn't experience it as a dragging, you know, like as something that dragged.
He definitely has pace down.
Yeah.
And knowing when enough is enough.
Yeah.
Maybe not in a total running time.
Yeah.
But certainly scene by scene.
Yeah.
I was just thinking maybe the handheld Dogme style might be more of a precursor to something like The Office than and that whole trend of, you know, documentary style.
Faux documentary.
Yeah, faux documentary style movies and TV shows rather than Breaking Bad. I mean, Breaking Bad and those films, definitely the theme, you know, and The Wire, like that kind of ambition.
They're a lot more cinematic in style, but I think aesthetically Breaking Bad definitely looks like... parts of Traffic,
and
like
Betty, all of the Better kind Call of Saul as well has that.
Yeah, that really visual, washed out, you know, lemon coloured kind of vistas.
Yeah, okay, yeah, like,
and the desert. Soundtrack. Yeah, the desert, and the soundtrack,
drugs,
drugs,
drugs, bad.
Come on, why did you hate it, Carla?
I didn't look. I didn't hate it, but I just found it really boring, and I respect it for its ambition, but I've been trying to unpack what it is about it that I just found it really fucking corny, and I found it... What I really put my finger on is, like, he said that he wanted to make a movie about drugs that wasn't about drug addicts. Okay, two thumbs. But it really smacked me of, like, I don't want to say a privileged white guy, but in that arena of people telling stories about things that they don't really know anything about, and it just... And so there was all these, like, really corny moments in it that just I found really distasteful. Like, You know, the first time the 16-year-old girl like smokes crack and she like cry, like just a single tear rolls down her face of ecstasy.
Storyline really problematic.
It's so disgusting. And, you know, like I've known a lot of teenage drug addicts in my time, and first of all, none of them come from those sides of the tracks. Second of all, you know, that she ends up being pimped out by her drug dealer at the age of 16 or 17. Like, I just found that, like, level of the, you know, the ironic, like, drug governor guy that his daughter ends up being a prostituted drug addict. It's just... I just found it really naff.
I thought so too. That did actually happen in the original series. So, like, he didn't make that up, but I think it could have been cut, because I agree. I think it was like, we need a white girl for people to relate to these stories. Like, that's how I read it. It was kind of like, we need a nice
It could have been toned kid. The fuck down.
Yeah.
Like, you know, she could have had a nice, like, bong habit or, you know, like, a coke habit and, like, got pregnant or something like that, and it still would have had
more Degrassi level
and it's just it would have just been more believable, and it would have been as impactful, I think, to Michael Douglas, this character. And I didn't believe Catherine Zeta-Jones turning, like, straight away into, like, middle-class drug lord. That was so fucking stupid.
Well, that her character is, like, a precursor to, like, some other characters in that world of drug stories. Like, it made me think of that great show by Kenji... what's her name?
Weeds.
Weeds. Yeah. It made me think of the Weeds character a little bit.
That was way more believable, though, on Weeds. And again, it's just she's growing weed. She's not, like, going from...
to Mexico.
...having a fucking country club meal to, like, hiring an assassin to kill the guy who's going to testify against her husband.
I think some of that's set up, though. Like, Dennis Quaid says to her, like, you know, when I first met you, something like, you were from the wrong side of the tracks and I could see you would do anything to survive. And I could see, you know, it's like the country club... is something that she's adopted.
She's, like, a trophy wife. Like, she's self-styled.
Yeah. And then when all this goes down, she, like, goes back to those instincts of, what do I have to do to survive? Fine, I'll sell some drugs.
So that's fine. But then if she's really like that from the past, she would have known everything about her husband.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, like, there's just so many gaps in the storyline in my... So, like, honestly, this was just 2.5 hours of me rolling my eyes.
I thought there were some pretty great characters in it, though. Like
Benicio del Toro.
Benicio del Toro was amazing. Love. He, for me, was the best thing in the film, like, without a doubt.
That's one of the notes I actually wrote, was Benicio del Toro gay bar baseball cut Lacoste t-shirt with a cigarette packet underneath the shoulder.
Incredible.
Stop.
And Frankie Flowers, that character was great, like the hitman. And that whole Don Cheadle and Luis Guzman again.
That was wonderful. Fantastic. That was actually wonderful,
I love when they're sitting in the truck and he's like, you know, I really want to get this woman. I really want to get one of those big time, like, one of those white people.
That is actually one thing I really loved about this film, that the brown people were prosecutors or working for the, you know, quote unquote good side.
I think I kind of agree with you. Like, I saw all those moments of shit, but I also, like, loved so much about it. Like, I think it's a pretty incredible film in a lot of ways. And I do think kind of incredible that it's so experimental. Like, he did, you know, like, he says himself that he, like, didn't know what he was doing half the time with some of these experimental processes he was doing. And that's amazing because it's a $49 million film.
Yeah. Sorry, I feel like I'm talking a lot.
No, I didn't have anything there. I was just, you know, nodding vaguely.
Well, I have two... There's still, even in this film, like, there was two... There's quite a lot of little micro moments that I was like, that's so fucking cool, and you would never see that in any other director's film, was, like, when all the ladies who lunch were sitting down and lunching and they were actually eating the food and they were talking about how much they love food.
Yeah.
I was just like, whoa, I have literally never seen that in any Hollywood movie my whole life, women eating food.
Yeah.
And also that Catherine Zeta-Jones was allowed to keep her Welsh accent, that, you know, that she was just a Welsh person living in America, you know. Mm. So I thought that was really cool too. Like, this kind of white Americanizing of everything is kind of annoying. But I can totally understand. And it's like, that's the thing that irritates me. Like, I know why it won the Oscar, because it's like a whole bunch of white people were just slapping themselves on the back going, oh, yeah, I understand things way more now. Thanks, Steven Soderbergh. And this is, like, experimental just enough to win. You know, like, he didn't go crazy, you know. So you're in this very narrow band of being able to win. I really admire what he was trying to do with this film. Like, don't get me wrong, I think it's an admirable thing to try to start thinking about the world in a holistic way and to understand how, you know, so many different things feed into, say, the industrial war machine or, you know, the drug industry. But it just was just a little not my...
Maybe too, it's just a little bit too much of its time, you know?
And I think that's a good point,
too. The kind of sensibility of it that, you know, to sell this material, it had to have those kind of hooks.
I'd never seen it before until yesterday either.
Yeah,
so.
That's probably a big part of it because it felt so new at the time and never seen a film like this, never seen subject matter dealt with like this. And, yeah, in the intro we're talking about all the other shows that have done five seasons out of this idea.
So, yes, that's right, exactly. Played it out over a longer period of time kind of thing.
And it definitely... we're so used to it. Yeah. It definitely spurred, like, a whole bunch of other massive ensemble piece socio-political films to come after it as well.
Syriana, which was written and directed by the writer of Traffic, certainly felt like Traffic Part 2.
Syriana is such an intense film. Yeah. It's really... whoa.
There's something about the texture of the way the actors work that I think, you know, that's why he is an actor whisperer, that he... you know, there's something about the way that they express themselves on screen that isn't cliched, even in the most mainstream or straightforward stories. Even if there are moments of shit, there's still something that sort of engages you about performances in Soderbergh films. I was going to ask as well, like, he really has changed or, you know, done so much for, the, you know, advancing filmmaking, especially in Hollywood. Even if he's brought things like Dogma or other styles that have already been happening into a mainstream audience, but so many people don't know who he is.
Yeah, you know, it's really weird.
Only, you know, cinephile, like people who love cinema.
Who have done enough Googling on IMDb to join the dots.
I think that's the way he wants it, though. Like, he kind of says about Aaron Brockovich that, like, there are some films where it's appropriate for the director to get in between the audience and the screen and wave their hands around, and that film wasn't one of those films. And he sort of says from that point on he tries to kind of remove himself, and I think his model for a great film career is John Huston, is someone who just kind of, like, keeps, you know, like... making films their whole life, and it's not about them. It's like about, we've talked about this before, but I do think that this is, you know, this is why people don't know him, because he just doesn't insert himself. It's not about him.
He, when he won the Oscar for directing this film, beating out Steven Soderbergh for Aaron Brockovich, everyone thought he wouldn't win. He'd split the vote, but he did, and he gets up and instead of a heartfelt, wow, this means so much to me, this is for all the people, he's like, everyone out there, go and create, go and make something.
Yeah.
He's just so desperate to create and have other people create and make something. It doesn't matter what form it is. It just it happens to be an Oscar-winning film from time to time. But, yeah, I think he's so much about the process of creating, and that really comes through.
Yeah.
The biggest revelation I had about him watching this film was, and I talked about it in the first episode about how, you know, when you talk about him, well, when I've talked about him with friends, people think that he's queer because he has just such a beautiful design aesthetic and he tells, you know, positive stories about women or has, you know, meaty roles for women. His politics seem very different to what you would think, like what you're experienced with a cis white male director. And I really realised with this film is that it's actually his aesthetic is he's European. He has a European film aesthetic and the way that he tells his stories and the stories that he's interested in. And that's the reason why he does not fit in anywhere. He doesn't fit in with Hollywood film. He doesn't fit in with gay cinema, queer cinema, art house cinema. He's almost like... and you picked up on it really early on. He's almost like Wim Wenders to me because Wim Wenders is like an American director... in my mind, who's been born in Germany. It's really strange. Like, he makes such amazing films about America and Americans that, so that whole... I just realised he's a European transplant.
I think that's spot on. I also think what you guys said a couple of episodes ago is spot on, where he was... You know, if all he'd made after Sex Lies was, like, Kafka and King of the Hill and The Underneath, we wouldn't be talking about him. But he sort of had that reset of, like, he was trying to force himself into what Hollywood wanted and then realized what his own aesthetic was and then realized he could just bring that to the process. And Yeah, and then we really saw what he was interested in, it both in terms of theme and in terms of, you know, the technical process. And I think the European thing is spot on.
Yeah.
And that's such a value-adding process for us as an audience, because there's so much crap that Hollywood churns out, that to know that there's this director who's, like, still kind of has this Hollywood tradition, you know, like, it's not like he poo-poos that, but, like, brings so much more to it.
Yeah.
Which is why it's exciting to see him make big budget films. Which brings us to Ocean's 11. Are we talking about that today? No? Oh, they're shaking their heads.
Well, that brings us to actually time to press pause.
Press pause, press pause.
So, what have you guys got?
I'm sure you've got heaps of goss.
I've got one for each film. Oh. For Erin Brockovich, okay, there's that. What is the most famous line in that film?
It's called boobs.
Yeah. And it's sort of, it's a very funny line, and it's funny because it comes after Ed saying, so how did you get all these documents? Out of context, it's very strange. And and because of that, I mean, hell, I quoted it out of context before in a Jack Nicholson voice. So, you know, it's obviously seeped into the pop culture. But it became such a popular line that every ad we would see for Erin Brockovich is playing on TV, there'd just be a shot of Julia Roberts saying, they're called boobs, Ed. And you know, what is that meant to tell me?
Yeah.
And I think it got... Like, I thought about it a lot because it's on the back of the DVD cover, a quote, they're called boobs, Ed. No context. Don't even know it's her saying it. It's just the word boobs. And I think because Julia Roberts was, you know, she's America's sweetheart. And despite having got her big break playing a sex worker, she is strangely, up until this point, she's not been very sexualized. Mm. And seeing her in these... Mm. Low-cut tops, short dresses, everything pushed up. It was very disconcerting because that was not the Julia Roberts we'd been seeing for the previous decade. And I think it was that sort of thrill of, oh, she's sexualized now. She said the word boobs. Let's just play that clip forever. And but also because it was a funny line, you want to be reminded of the time there was a funny line. And it's this weird thing where, you know, about 10 years ago, the real Erin Brockovich started doing ads in Australia. Do you remember these for a law firm?
No.
And I just started expecting her to say at the end of the ad, go, she's looking at the camera going, shine lawyers, they're called boobs. Like, I thought that was a real missed opportunity.
You should send her the memo.
Yeah.
I actually I was looking up Erin Brockovich the other day, doing a bit of Googling, and found, like, in the last sort of couple of months or maybe year or so, she had been busted for drunk driving a boat. And they've got her mugshot.
Sounds amazing.
And it's awful. It's like she's all fucked up looking and, you know, it's kind of, it feels like a real, you know, like a slap in the face to Erin, like, you know, and she sort of issued an apology about it, and apparently she wasn't actually driving the boat, she was on the boat. I don't know the full details, but it felt like a real shaming Erin Brockovich moment. Mm. It's still funny, it's still worth looking up, but it's a bit Kenny Powers to be drunk driving a boat.
Yeah, well, my partner has been saying that they're called boobs, Ed, line the whole time that I've been like, so that, yeah, like, it was weird watching the movie and being like, when's she going to say it? When's she going to say it? But I don't really have much on Erin Brockovich, except that the other, you know, dumb association that I have with it is that a friend of mine in high school used to call it Erin Broccoli Bitch.
Wow.
So every time I think of the film, that is in my head. Erin Broccoli Bitch.
I was totally high the entire time before that movie and for about 10 years afterwards. But I have no recollection of ever knowing that line, ever hearing it. And I was watching the movie with my boyfriend last night and he's like, here comes the line. And I was like, what? And he's just, and she does it. And he's like, don't you remember? I'm like, no. He's just.
It's like a Rocky Horror thing. You're going to quote along with it.
He was completely blown away that I didn't know. And I think the thing that we're blown away with Julia Roberts is because she used a body double for Pretty Woman. And so she hasn't really, like, actually. And so I was like, whoa, Julia Roberts. So I think that's probably where a lot of the shock comes from as well. Because, yeah, who knew? But I actually have a personal connection to this movie.
Mm.
So this is a good... piece of goss. I actually met Marg Helgenberger.
Oh, wow.
Who is the main character afflicted with, I don't know, 4 billion tumors in the movie. Yeah. So I met her about 2 years ago in a airport lounge, because all of my shit was over a seat in like an executive lounge. She's like, "Oh, excuse me, you know, is anyone sitting there?" I'm like, "No," and I just got all my stuff. She's like, "Thanks, how's your day going?" I'm just like, "I can't even talk to you." I'm like, "Good," because she was in these like just yoga pants and a crop top and a cardigan, and her body is incredible. Like, she must be like in middle age now, but like, so she looks like she lifts weights. Like, she's like the size of a 10-year-old boy, but she's huge. So it was just this unexpected moment after I'd been awake for like 32 hours and I was like all greasy, and she's just like standing there talking, you know, eating some watermelon out of a little cup. So that's my Erin Brockovich.
What about traffic?
Connection.
any traffic connections?
I have a slightly self-indulgent story about traffic. Well, no, because yours actually has a point to it. Mine's just talking about myself. So I had a TV show about 6 years ago on the ABC called The Bizarro Project, and then we had an episode about drugs in cinema, and we were running through a list of like what has film taught us, and we got to the traffic bit where we said traffic taught us the inescapable truth that blue equals Washington and yellow equals Mexico. And I think there was a review in The Age that said, "Oh yeah, they really get stuck into traffic. Traffic sucks." I was like, no, that wasn't the point. No, and I started thinking about how, like, Stanley Kubrick used to comb over every press mention of any of his films from anywhere in the world. Yeah, you know, newspapers coming from Japan, and he'd be checking the size of the ads. I thought, what if Steven Soderbergh is checking every press mention, and now the press has said, "I don't like traffic," and then obsessed over that for 6 years. So,
Steven, are you listening?
Yeah. I think you're good. It's all right.
Probably, yeah. I'm sure he doesn't care.
That's so funny. I thought it was funny to add to our Steven Soderbergh casting spotto game ongoing. Did anyone spot John Slattery from Mad Men?
Oh yeah,
in Traffic. It's a great cameo.
Oh yes. Yeah. Yes, I was like, I was trying to remember who he is, but yes.
Yeah, he's Roger Sterling.
Yeah, he's Roger Sterling, yes. Yeah.
With slightly darker hair, I think, a bit younger.
And also, I'm obsessed with Deadwood, and Drunk Tom from Deadwood was Mark Hilgenberger's husband.
That's right.
In this movie, yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
He's also one of the prison psychologist from Orange is the New Black,
yeah.
And also the older lesbian academic from Transparent.
Mm-hmm. Cherry Jones?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. I love Soderbergh spotto.
Cherry Jones, who is actually partners with the Jill Soloway, who makes Transparent. Yeah. Not Cherry Jones. Cherry Jones plays an Eileen Miles type character. Jill Soloway is married to Eileen Miles, who is a lesbian feminist, very famous poet. Okay. And Cherry Jones is a, a character like her.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. The other thing that I wanted to say about Traffic was that Soderbergh did the cinematography, but to do that, he actually had to join the local 600 cinematographers union to do it. He had to get his union card and like so that he could have a credit, which I thought was pretty funny, that he just was like, "Nah, I'm just doing this. I'm just becoming a cinematographer."
Mm. And it gets to the point soon in his career now when he starts writing, shooting, editing his films, and there's like rules in the associations and the unions that you can't do all of those things on a film.
Yeah.
So that's where he starts getting all of the new, like, you know, nom de plumes coming up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think as cinematographer, he's Peter Andrews, which is his father's names. And as an editor, he's Mary Bernard, I think, which is his mother's first two names.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Control freak.
But that's what's interesting is that I feel like even though it seems like on paper it looks like, oh, he's becoming more of a control freak, I feel like he actually becomes less of a control freak. Like, he becomes more loose and freewheeling in like how he shoots things and
with
how
smaller
he...
crews, I guess.
Yeah. It just enables him to become much more agile
in
his career. And now he's shooting films on iPhone 7s. Who knows what the fuck's going to happen now?
That agility thing. He does talk in the deleted scenes on Erin Brockovich. He talks about his favorite day of shooting, and it's the montage of like Erin pulling like files and going through the thing, and because it's just two people in a room, it's like, now that's filmmaking. It's not thousands of people standing around.
I have one, and I think I didn't fact check it, but I'm pretty sure that this is right, that this is the film that Catherine Zeta-Jones and Michael Douglas met on, and how they got together.
I think they were already together.
Oh, were they?
Yeah, I think.
Because she's pregnant in that film, isn't she?
I mean, that was fast work from Michael, if they did meet on that film. But no.
That's how he rolls, don't you know?
That was the first film they were in together.
Oh, okay, I got it wrong. Yeah. Oh, bummer.
So that brings us to the end of our episode, with extra special thanks to our guest, Lee Zachariah. Next month, we'll be back with Rat Pack Remake and preeminent Cupcake Ocean's 11, an apparently unofficial sequel to Sex, Lies and Videotape, Full Frontal. Very much looking forward to that, maybe.
James Spader in it?
No, it doesn't. If you haven't caught up on our earlier episodes, there's still time to get up to scratch on the chronological filmography of Steven Soderbergh. You can subscribe to us on Beyond Pod, TuneIn, iTunes, and wherever great podcasts are found. Thanks as always to Zeph Anastasio, our sound engineer extraordinaire and gracious host. We'd love to hear from you, hear about your impressions of Soderbergh films, or your favourite bits of Soderbergh trivia. You can contact the team at club@clubsoderbergh.com, Facebook page Club Soderbergh, Twitter @ClubSoderbergh, and we'd really love to be engaged with other Soderbergh fans, so please don't be shy. See you in a month for more Club Soderbergh.